Well, I'm very grateful for everybody's attendance this morning. To our visitors, I want to encourage you one more time to fill out a visitor's card so that at the appropriate time during our worship service, you might place it in the basket as it goes by. We simply want to acknowledge and thank you for your presence today and extend to you an offer to study the Bible. That if you have questions about the good news of salvation that's freely offered to all, then we want to sit down and study through those questions with you and give you Bible answers to those Bible questions. Now, this is the time of year where charity is often on our minds. We think about charity because this is the time of year where the weather gets quite a bit cooler, a little bit more challenging for those who have a difficult time. It's also the time of year where charities come and knock on our doors and ask for donations. This is the time of year where I feel like almost every day that I'm here at the office, I get a knock at the door. And it's somebody asking for assistance of some kind, whether it's assistance with a rent payment or making a grocery bill. And how do I answer that? How do I answer that when somebody comes to this place and asks for assistance from the Monte Vista Church of Christ? Now, if you're familiar at all with our congregation, then you understand that we don't have a fund that is set up by this church to help those who are non-church members with those financial or physical means. I suppose then the question is, why? Why don't we have a food bank set up? Why don't we have a fund that is set aside in our church treasury from the collection taken up on Sunday that is there to help people with blankets and clothes and rent payments? Why don't we do that? Is there a biblical explanation? Is there a practical explanation? And is there an alternative that the Bible suggests that works even better? I hope to answer these questions with you this morning. I know that a lesson like this is probably not going to be the sort of lesson where you're going to come forward at the end of the lesson to obey the invitation. It's not necessarily a gospel-y sort of sermon. But I hope that you can recognize in lessons like this, where we get to the nitty-gritty of some of the application, the authority of the Scriptures, I hope that you can recognize that everything that we study in the Bible is an important topic. Every conclusion that is rightly come to from the Scriptures is a right conclusion because it is derived from God and His authority as He reveals His will in the Scriptures. So maybe something like this is not going to be what converts you to Jesus Christ. But recognizing the value of Scripture in every question of life and the light that Scripture sheds on it, maybe recognizing that is a good first step to meeting God through His Son, Jesus Christ. So let's enter into our study then and ask a few of these questions. It is very common to hear a knock at the door here at the church building or to get a phone call at the church phone number and find an eager hand asking for help. And again, why does our congregation not collectively participate in secular charities to those who are not Christians? One point of clarification, of course, is that our congregation most certainly does practice charity to our members. There have been plenty of members here at Monte Vista, you know who you are, who've been helped by this congregation. Our own members who have been helped during times of financial crisis. Our own members who have been helped when a hospital bill has been too big to handle on their own. We have members who have been helped with furniture or filling up a home, filling up an apartment, help with moving expenses, help with grocery bills. Our own members are supported within this congregation. So that's one point of clarification a lot of people forget about is, why doesn't your church practice charity? Well, we do practice charity. We do practice charity. Maybe it's not always the kind of charity that's recognizable to outsiders, but I know that our elders have been incredibly charitable, that our own members have been incredibly charitable with the kind of charity that's outlined in the Scriptures. So what is the Bible model then? If you look in the New Testament, is there a model, is there a pattern that's given in the New Testament that gives us some idea of where the authority is in how we act and how we're to spend money from the church treasury? Now, I've got a series of scriptures here. There's quite a few of them. We won't have time to talk about all of them in detail. So if you want to study them a little bit further, then write them down or ask me for my notes after the lesson. But in Acts chapter 2, notice in Acts chapter 2, this is the first one here that we'll notice. In Acts chapter 2, verses 44 and 45, and all those who had believed were together and had all things in common. And they began selling their property and their possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need. So that's the kind of benevolence that you see, first of all, from Christianity. And remember, Christianity is very new here in Acts chapter 2. Only days old at this point. And yet, right away you see a model that becomes clear, which is that Christians take care of other Christians, first and foremost. That when you see a Christian in need, you do whatever it takes to make sure that that Christian is taken care of. Now, here's the thing. Something becomes very clear from this passage in Acts chapter 2, which is this, that the church in Jerusalem had financial resources to help those who were in need. It says that everybody had what they needed. The rich were selling possessions and donating the resources to those who were poor. The church in Jerusalem had financial resources to help those who were needy. So why is it that when we get to Acts chapter 3, and when the apostles are going to the temple at the hour of prayer, they encounter an individual, a man who had been lame for many years and who was now a beggar. And this beggar would beg alms from those who were entering the temple during the hour of prayer. And of course, Peter and the apostles encounter him here, and they stop and look at him, and he expects that they're going to give him something. And yet Peter says in verse 4 of Acts 3, "Look at us." Almost like, look at us. Does it look like we're in a position to help you financially? And he began to give them his attention, expecting to receive something from them. But Peter said, "I do not possess silver and gold." Now, the rest of the story is a sermon all its own, but let's just focus on that one point here. Only a few verses earlier in Acts chapter 2, it is made abundantly clear that the church in Jerusalem had financial resources available to help those who were in need. Everybody had all things in common. Those who were poor had what they needed. Those who were rich were selling their possessions and giving to those in need. The church in Jerusalem had the money to help poor people. And yet Peter looks at a poor person who is not a Christian and says, "I don't have money for you. I don't have money for you." I think right there, based on these two passages alone, you have an example that's set up there where clearly a church can have resources, but its resources are given first and foremost to its own members who have a need. And to outsiders from that treasury, there is no gold to be given, no gold or silver from that treasury. Paul was an apostle. We presume that at some point he became an elder as well of the church in Jerusalem. So if an apostle and an elder of a congregation can look at a poor person and say, "I don't have access to money to give to you," I think that gives us some clarity, some clarification, some explanation as we move forward. Acts chapter 4, verses 32 through 35 notes that there was not a needy person among them. The phrase "among them" indicates to me that there was not a needy person among the Christians in that group. Acts chapter 11, verse 29, this was money that was for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 1, the collection for the saints. So the collection, by the way, that's within the context of the collection that we take up on Sunday. The collection is for the saints. Not for just anything, not for just helping anybody pay a bill, but the collection that we take up as a congregation is for the work of the church. It's for the saints, to support preachers, to support Christians who have a physical need. In Acts chapter 2, again, we noted verses 44 and 45 that it was only those who were believing who were being helped by the finances of that congregation. Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, clearly gives the example that it was the widows who were members of that church who were receiving their ration of food. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 4, the support of the saints, he says. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 1, it is a ministry to the saints. Romans chapter 15, verses 25 through 26, is exclusive in nature, that it was only the poor and the needy who were members of the church in Jerusalem who were receiving the funds being sent from Macedonia and Achaia. Widows in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 10. Widows in that passage who are put on a roll of financial assistance from the church are clearly members of that church. That is the model in the New Testament. Collective benevolence is always from Christians to other Christians. And there is not a single example in the entire New Testament where collective benevolence is given to unbelievers. Only those who were saved were sharing and having all things in common collectively. And that is every New Testament example without exception. In all of these passages, it's to the saints, to the brethren, to the needy who were among them, to this church, to that church. It is always in that context that collective benevolence is shared. But what about, there's a few passages here. What about these passages? Because there are a few passages that seem to give some indication that a church can, from its treasury, provide benevolence to just anybody. Let's look at a few of these passages. What about Galatians 6 and verse 10? That says, so then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. And again, some people say that since this verse is addressed to the churches of Galatia, contextually, the whole book is to the churches of Galatia, that it permits those churches to do good to those outside of the household of faith from its own church treasury. And the argument, of course, is we're told to do good to all men, therefore we can set up a food bank at the church building for the homeless in our community. We can help those with rent and bills from our church treasury. But you know, the dangerous thing here is to assume that everything written in this epistle, or everything written in every New Testament epistle, is meant to apply to the church and not the individual. Just because something is written in a New Testament book doesn't mean that it always applies to the group. Often there are passages that are indicated that are clearly being written to an individual and an individual's obligation. The context of Galatians 6, for example, is very clearly individualistic. Look at Galatians 6 broadly, and you'll see this played out. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1, you see the phrase yourself. And you, individual. In verse 2, one another. Again, one another places the emphasis on individuals. Verse 3, anyone thinks that he is. Any one individual. Verse 4, let each one. Verse 5, each one of you shall bear his own load. Verse 6, let the one, verse 7, whatever a man, singular. Verse 8, for the one. The we in verse 10 of Galatians 6 is not the group. It is not the church. It's individuals. And the whole context of Galatians chapter 6 makes it clear that the things in that particular passage are of an individual nature. It's an individual obligation, not a group or collective or church obligation. Well, what about James chapter 1, verse 27? This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Now, many will utilize the same flawed logic from Galatians 6, verse 10, and argue that whatever the individual can do well, then the group can do as well. After all, why wouldn't God want His church to participate in pure and undefiled religion if James 1 says pure and undefiled religion is to help orphans and widows in their distress? And yet the context has to be carefully considered. Just like in Galatians 6, look at the context of James chapter 1. Other verses, verses 3, 4, and 5, use the phrase, any of you. In verse 6, let him. Verse 12, blessed is a man. Verse 13, let no one say. Verse 14, each one. Verse 19, every one. Verse 22, prove yourselves. Verse 23, anyone. Verse 24, he. Verse 25, one. Verse 26, this man's singular, this man's religion is worthless. In fact, the verse itself is individual in nature when it uses the phrase, keep oneself unstained by the world. So even within that verse, you have an individual directive to keep one's self. Now, I'm not arguing that the church can't participate in pure and undefiled religion, but I would make the argument that James 1, verse 27 is not talking about a church participating in pure and undefiled religion, but the individual Christian participating in pure and undefiled religion. After all, this idea of keep oneself unstained by the world, that's the other part of it. People only want to focus on this idea of helping widows and orphans in their distress. But it's not the church's obligation to keep me from staining myself by the world. That's up to me. That's an expression of pure and undefiled religion in my personal life, where I help widows and orphans in their distress, and I make sure that I keep myself unstained by the world. But then in 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 13, because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. Now the phrase there, to them and to all. The to them is referring to the Christians in Judea who were being helped by this collection. There was a famine in that part of the world, so churches and Christians from other parts of the world were collecting resources to be sent to those Christians in Judea to help them during that time of famine. Now that's not something anybody argues about. But then you get to them and to all. And a lot of people want to take the phrase to all and apply that to everybody, regardless of whether they believe in Jesus Christ or not. The end to all, however, I don't think refers to all people. I think it refers to all Christians. I think within that context, he's saying to them, the Christians in Judea, and to all other Christians as well. And the reason why I say that is this, that when you look at the context of 2 Corinthians 9, you're not talking about unbelievers there. The end to all is not referring to unbelievers. Look at the response. When this contribution gets to them and to all, this is the response of those who receive that contribution. It says in verse 13 that they will glorify God, that the Christians in Corinth had obeyed God in following this. Glorifying God, I don't know that every unbeliever who receives charitable contributions necessarily glorifies God because of that charity. In verse 14, it says that they will pray for the Corinthians. And again, that's not the response of an unbeliever. The unbeliever doesn't necessarily pray for the Christians who give him that charity. They'll yearn for them in verse 14, and one day they'll reciprocate, 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 14, within that very context. These are not the responses of unbelievers. To pray for them in Corinth, to yearn for them in Corinth, to praise God because of this, Those aren't the responses of unbelievers. Those are the responses of Christians. It sure doesn't sound like these are unbelievers who are responding to the charity here. I simply don't think that you've got a leg to stand on if you can take 2 Corinthians 9 verse 13 and say that that end to all refers to all people anywhere regardless of their belief in Jesus Christ. Well, why does this even matter? I suppose might be the next question. Ryan, aren't you kind of quibbling about this? It just seems like kind of a measly argument to make. Like you're being a little bit too specific, a little bit too picky. Does this really even matter to make such a distinction in our benevolence between believers and unbelievers? What's really the harm in having a Monte Vista Church of Christ food bank? What's really the harm in having a fund that's set up, that's taken from our treasury, that helps people with rent and their electric bills and whatnot? What? Ryan, I just don't see what the real harm is here in trying to delineate between this money over here and that money. And the argument often goes like this. From my personal bank account, I donate money to the collection basket on Sunday. My money goes to the church treasury, right? Now, I have a personal obligation to act in a benevolent way to all people. And by the way, there's nothing in this lesson that says we shouldn't practice charity. We just need to practice it in a way that's scriptural, in a way that's biblical. But the argument goes, well, I give money from my bank account to the church treasury. And then I give money from my bank account to this charitable organization. Why are you just creating a middle step there? Why can't I just give money from my bank account to the church that covers all of those things? Why are you dividing money up? Why does it matter that this check goes to the church and this check goes to the Red Cross? It all comes from the same pot, doesn't it? It all comes from the same checking account, doesn't it? Here's my problem with that argument. When we designate money for a certain purpose, aren't we designating it as something special? And doesn't that count for something? Doesn't it mean something? When you put money in your 401k, you put money in your retirement, doesn't that money mean something? Otherwise, why do we have the retirement account? If it all comes from the same place and it's all going to end up in the same place, back in my hands, why create an extra step? Why create a middleman? Why not just put all of your money in a mattress? Right? What does it matter to designate money for something special? What does it matter to divide up your money into this account or that account when it all comes from the same place and it's all going to end up in the same place? And yet we value the money that we set aside in savings because it means something to us. A college fund means something. And when you take that small amount of money from your paycheck, however much it is, and you say, that money is going to my kid's college fund, that means something to you. It's not just any money. There is a feeling of euphoria that you get because you look at the money in that college fund, in that savings account, and you see it grow and grow and grow, and that means something to you. The money that you set aside for Christmas presents this year, you budgeted for it, you set it aside, you put it away. That money means something. Because the money that you spent on your Christmas present for your wife means more to you than the money you spent on your electric bill this month. It means more to you. Why is it that we have that piggy bank that we fill up for that vacation that we want to take to the Bahamas? We put our nickels and dimes in a $5 bill every now and then. That money means something because we're setting aside for something special, for that trip that we've always wanted to take. So I guess I just don't think the argument has any flotation at all. The money that I put in the collection plate means something because when I put money in the collection plate for the work at Monte Vista, I am confident that what we're doing with that money is both right and scriptural. I'm putting money in a collection plate to save souls, to support the work that goes on here, and to support the work that goes on all around the world and the preachers that we support. It means something to me that when I put money in the collection plate here at Monte Vista, that money is going to help Christians here and Christians abroad. That money means something to me. Not only because it's right, but because it's scriptural. And I take that seriously. And I want to know that when I put money in a collection plate, that our elders are going to use it in a scriptural way. I'm sorry, but if you're still arguing about the scripturality, if you're still arguing about the model that we find in the New Testament, the pattern that we see, read those verses again. To the saints, to the brethren, to the church. Every single one of those verses makes it clear that collective benevolence is from Christians to other Christians. Now, I have other money that I spend on unbelievers. And I do spend money on unbelievers because there are a lot of people out there who have needs. And I don't want to forget them. I don't want to neglect them. Which leads to our last point. Benevolence is individual by nature. It is individual by nature. Putting money in a collection plate is not benevolence to unbelievers. Let me give you a few passages here. First of all, are we practicing what we preach? Are we being consistent in giving generously to those who are less fortunate, including unbelievers and strangers? I think one of the arguments that people sometimes make is that when you have a model like ours, you tend to neglect unbelievers. And I suppose that might be true in some circles. I suppose that might be true in some churches. I don't think that it's true here because I am personally aware of quite a bit of charity work that goes on in our own midst. But I suppose it's an argument that some people might level. Say, if you're not going to have a church food bank and you're not going to have a food kitchen and you're not going to have a fund that gives Christmas presents to those who are less fortunate, then you tend to ignore all of those who are less fortunate. And again, I don't think that plays out everywhere, maybe in some circles, but it's an argument to think about. Do we practice what we preach? If we're going to say that benevolence to unbelievers is individual by nature, then we better have individuals here who are practicing benevolence to unbelievers. You've got to practice that charity. Those passages that we read in James chapter 1 and 2 Corinthians 9 and other places, those apply to you. To practice pure and undefiled religion is to take care of widows and orphans in their distress. Are you practicing pure and undefiled religion? Are you helping widows and orphans in their distress? Out of your own finances and your own checking account, are you doing that? The problem is that when we think that church benevolence is the same thing as individual benevolence, we're missing out on what real benevolence is. There's a term I came up with, and I call it outsourced benevolence. You hear that term every now and then in business circles of jobs being outsourced, where you take jobs from within or jobs in this country or jobs in a company and you outsource them to somewhere else to save money. If somebody in China can do it cheaper, then we're going to send that job over there is essentially what it is. Well, we do the same thing with our benevolence. If you think that putting a check in the collection basket is benevolence, all you've done is outsourced your individual obligation to unbelievers who are in need. That's all you've done. That's all you've done. You put a check in the collection plate and you said, there you go. I fed the hungry and I clothed the naked and I gave water to those who were thirsty. That was easy. That was convenient. That's my problem with the institutional model. My biggest problem, by the way. Not only is it not scriptural, but I don't think it works. Because then you have a whole church of people who are just putting money in a collection plate and leaving it up to a board to decide where that money goes. I put money in the collection plate, therefore I practiced benevolence. No, you didn't. You didn't practice benevolence. Not the way Jesus would have you practice it. When you read in Matthew chapter 25, verses 34 through 46, he talks about all the ways that when you saw someone who was hungry, you gave him food. And when you saw someone who was naked, you gave him clothes. When you saw someone who was thirsty, you gave him something to drink. You know who he's talking to? You and you and you and you and me. When you saw someone in need, you took from your own pocket and you helped that person. And that is not the same thing as putting money in a collection plate. Absolutely not the same thing. Let me tell you what the biggest difference is in practical terms. It is very easy for a needy unbeliever to take from an organization, to take from an institution, a faceless group, and to walk away unchanged. To show up at an institution and say, I would like my weekly bag of groceries, please. And I would like my money for my electric bill, please. And a pair of shoes would be nice while you're at it. He's taking from an organization. It's nameless, it's faceless, there's no personal connection whatsoever. And while some people might be changed by that, I can understand. Some people might be affected by that. I think the majority of people who come and take advantage of an organization walk away unchanged people. But when you put a face and a name to that charity, when you say, this is not from a group, this is not from an institution, this is not from an organization that you can just walk in and out and there's no responsibility or accountability, I want to help you. And from my own resources, I'm going to help you with that bill. And I'm going to help you with those groceries. And by the way, here's my phone number. Call me if you'd like to have a Bible study. You know, honestly, it's a lot harder to walk away from a face and a name than it is to walk away from an institution. The Bible's model for benevolence to unbelievers works because it keeps our resources within our own congregation to help those who are closest to us spiritually, our brothers and sisters in Christ. And it keeps our personal resources out in the world, where we as individuals can be evangelists for Christ. Where we as individuals can leave an impression, a personal impression on unbelievers who have a need. There is absolutely nothing in this lesson where I'm trying to say, don't practice benevolence. Don't donate to charity. Don't help unbelievers. What I'm saying is, you must do those things. Because in doing those things, you show the Christian spirit on an individual basis to unbelievers. And you make it much more difficult for those unbelievers to simply take advantage of free stuff. You put a face and a name to that charity, and you just might leave an impression on someone that could last for eternity. That's as good a reason as any, to me, to practice the New Testament scriptural model for church benevolence. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. And don't think in any way I'm trying to make some kind of joke or some kind of plug here. Become a Christian, you get to take advantage of our charity now. No, become a Christian because you want to go to heaven. And Jesus makes it clear that when you cast off the world and you pick up the cross of Christ, you might sacrifice a lot of things in a worldly sense, but you take up a lot of things here in His kingdom. You will receive 100-fold in family members and in resources when you become a Christian and become a part of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. You'll be taken care of physically, but more importantly, you'll be taken care of spiritually. And that's our goal. That's what we want. Not to just feed people in this life, but to feed people the Word so that they can live for eternity with their Maker. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.